your opinion about the state of voting rights in general nationwide and how that relates in particular to Georgia. I wanted to ask, you know, some things about what has happened to you and also the Voting Rights Act and how it applies here. If you know much about what's been going on in Ohio, if you don't, that's fine, but I wanted to ask how that fits in to your perspective on the state of voting rights. And then my producer wanted to ask you about the effect of 9/11 on democracy and voting rights, and answer, you know, as broadly as you wish. And then I'll end up asking you about what's next, you know, for you and for America. In okay. Any particular order. Okay, well, no need to introduce yourself. Well, we all know Ms. Cynthia McKinney, one of our most respected congresspeople. And I wanted to ask you about your opinion about the status of voting rights in America. How do people have the same rights that they've fought for? Have voting rights eroded, or have they been enhanced lately? With everything you know, what's been going on?
First of all, you will... I want to thank you for doing this interview and for considering the topic of voting rights. Generally speaking, when people think of voting rights or talk of voting rights, they particularly have the civil rights era in mind when African Americans in this country were denied the right to vote. And as a result of the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, the right to vote was assured for African Americans, and later, as a result of amendments and Supreme Court decisions that affirmed that right, it was spread to language minorities and ethnic minorities as well. And so for a while, we thought that we had arrived in terms of the ability of people to cast their vote. And, of course, the corollary to that is to have representation. So one goes through the exercise of casting a vote for the purpose of having representation in this republic. But unfortunately, today, what we have is a diebold democracy. Our democracy has been privatized to a corporation that doesn't even share its private, its software, its codes, the construction of its machines and the way votes are tabulated with the people who pay them to do that. And so I would have to say that our democracy is in peril right now. In the film American Blackout, what I say to the anti-war masses who are largely white Americans in this country is that their most important objective ought to be to protect the right to vote for minorities in this country, for blacks and Latinos, because our votes alone can change the public policies that are made in Washington, D.C. and in state capitals across our country. That has got to be the centerpiece of the progressive agenda for this country. And so if you are concerned about democracy and voting rights in America, central to that is the concern for the right to vote and the right to representation for African Americans and other minorities in this country.
A lot of the legislative changes, such as the voter ID law that was on the books briefly here in Georgia, and the voter registration laws that were just overturned today in Florida, and of course Ohio now has a new voter ID law that's similar, seem to disproportionately affect people of lower income, especially people of color and immigrants. Do you think that there's a deliberate pattern here to target, as you say, minority voters based on their political orientation?
The powers that be have always been threatened by the true rainbow coalition of black people and white people and all kinds of people from different ethnicities and backgrounds and religions all coming together to make America a better place. That's why we understand from the reading of the COINTELPRO papers, the counterintelligence program papers, that their greatest fear was, in fact, that black leaders would be able to attract white support. And so, first and foremost, they had to use the power of the media to discredit black leaders. And in so doing, they would encourage whites to shy away from that kind of black leadership that was going to demand a better America for everybody, not just for black America, but for all Americans. And so I think back on what President Kennedy said when he talked about peace. And he said, what kind of peace do we want? Not a Pax Americana built on America's weapons of war, but a peace for all people, for all men and women, a peace for all time. And that is what the, I think, the base ideas of America are all about. A peace for all time and an America that gets along with the rest of the world. And so if you have good thinking Americans who are willing to listen to good, active black leadership and other leadership, minority leadership in general, and fashion public policy that addresses those real basic concerns, then we have an America that respects itself, respects its people, and respects the people of the world. That's what the powers that be are mightily afraid of. And that's why we have to work extra hard to make that happen. We can't be deterred. If you have come to the bastion of the Confederacy, you are in Georgia, where it's easy for a legislature to pass a voter ID bill that says that you've got to have our express form of identification before we're going to allow you to vote. Patently against the Voting Rights Act. You can see, you saw during the debate on the Voting Rights Act, where it was the Republicans of the Georgia delegation who were the most obstreperous in their antipathy toward extending the Voting Rights Act. And then, if it were to be extended, they said, don't apply it to Georgia. Why? Because Georgia has unfinished business. The unfinished business that was manifested on July 18th and August 8th in my own election. How can we have an open primary statute that still stands in the state of Georgia? A second primary statute that still stands in the state of Georgia? People in the rest of the country don't understand what happens down here in Georgia, where Republicans can cross over and pick up a Democrat ballot and vote in the Democratic primary. That doesn't happen anywhere in America except Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi, the heart of the Deep South. And why do we still have those statutes on our books? Because the Supreme Court of our country in 1954 made a breakthrough in civil rights for African Americans, and that was the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And then the legislature and successive legislatures in the state of Georgia enacted laws that said to the rest of the world, we white people in Georgia are going to show you that we are going to have the last word. And so that's why they put the St. Andrew's Cross, the stars and bars of the Confederacy, on our flag, which we just got rid of, but the base flag of Georgia still remains even today. At its foundation, a Confederate flag, a flag that is based on that heritage, that Southern heritage. Now, I'm a Southerner, and I'm proud of my Southern heritage, too. But I think at some point, the heritage needs to be placed in the history books, and America needs to move forward. And that's what we're trying to do. But, of course, we have the open primary, which allows the Republicans to cross over. We have the second primary, which says that a candidate has to win twice in order for them to win once. And where do these statutes come from? They come from the what's called the white resistance to the civil rights era. It's time for those statutes to be taken off the books in Georgia so that no other candidate can go through what I have gone through in two elections. I think I have set a record now. I've been kicked out of Congress more times than many people have been elected to Congress.
You talked about Republicans crossing over and voting in the Democratic primary. And, of course, in Ohio, we found that voters who showed up in the wrong line at a polling place that housed two precincts and accidentally went to the wrong table had their votes denied. They were either given provisional ballots, which weren't counted, or they were told that they could not vote, or that they had to wait in a very long line again, which was impossible for many. A lot of things have been happening around the country, various mechanisms in various states that have had the effect of disenfranchising voters, and these have disproportionately affected people of color. What would be an overall legislative solution? What would be the approach to crafting a solution? We had the Help America Vote Act, which, according to many voting rights activists, really didn't help anyone vote. What solutions would you propose?
Well, I think it's also important to note that the Voting Rights Act and the extension of the Voting Rights Act deal with 20th century problems. A Diebold democracy is a 21st century problem. And so we need the Voting Rights Act because there's still voter intimidation, there's still efforts to thwart and impede the ability of black people and minorities to vote, and not just to vote, but to have representation, because that's why we vote. So it's not that we that it's enough to be able to go and press a button or cast a ballot, but that's got to mean something at the end of the day in terms of who wins and who actually gets to press the yay or nay button in the city council or the school board or the state legislature or the United States Congress. It's got to mean something. And so that is also a right to representation. And it's the right to representation that is being taken away from the American people. It has always been taken away from African Americans. But now, because, I would say in large measure, because the progressive community in this country did not protect black people, now they are at risk too. For example, Florida and Ohio. We know that the Florida election, presidential election, was stolen. We know that. How was it stolen? It was stolen on the convicted felons list through voter intimidation, which has been ruled unconstitutional now. Thank goodness the state of Florida's got to change that. But the target of this disfranchisement were African-American voters. They were the target. The target of the disfranchisement in Ohio were African-American voters. And so George Bush sits in the White House today because the people around him were able to fashion a strategy to deny black people representation. Now, that representation was on the federal level at the White House. But the effect, nonetheless, is that black people voted overwhelmingly in Florida at nearly 100%. And that vote was against George Bush. But it didn't matter, because a scheme was put in place to steal their right to representation. Ohio, the same thing happened. It was carried out by a black man, which makes it even worse. But nonetheless, it was the same fix, the same political fix. Target the poor, the innocent, the marginalized. Target their hopes and their dreams and their aspirations for a better America. And the fact that they show up at the polls, some of them on crutches and canes, but they show up at the polls because they still have a belief in America and they want to make America better. And some cynic sitting in a back room is able to throw that away, to crumble it up, about like the television ad that was run in North Carolina against Harvey Gantt, where the white hand crumbles the piece of paper and throws it away because he says that a black man took his job. Or the Willie Horton ad that was used by George Bush's daddy to get elected. It's the same fix every time. Target the poor, the alienated, the marginalized, those who already have nothing. White America can't continue to fall for that trick, because if you fall for that trick again, you're the next one on the block.
You mentioned Ohio, whose Secretary of State Ken Blackwell is African American and has been accused of being responsible for numerous acts that have resulted in voter disenfranchisement, including in the Conyers report of the House Judiciary Committee, which did an extensive study of the impact of Blackwell's rulings on African-American voters there. And yet, Blackwell, although he's behind in the polls right now in the gubernatorial race behind his challenger Ted Strickland, many are speculating that that gap will narrow as the election approaches. Just today, there were press conferences held in both Cincinnati and Columbus with a number of African-American ministers, notably not from Ohio, declaring their support for Ken Blackwell based on his adherence to a religious platform that opposes abortion and opposes non-heterosexual unions, etc. And a portion of the black community does appear to be responding to that message. How much of representation, the question this brings up for me is, how much of representation is about the issues that candidates cover, and how much of it is about the presence or the aspirations toward numerical parity in the legislature?
The corporatists and the Republicans have been able to deconstruct a massive black political consensus. And so that's how you can get, sitting in a Thurgood Marshall seat, a Clarence Thomas. That's how you can get, carrying out foreign policy for this country, a Condoleezza Rice. They don't represent the black political consensus. What they represent is opportunism. Kenneth Blackwell is no different. If Kenneth Blackwell would do to African-American voters in Ohio what he did to them in 2004, he doesn't deserve African-American support. I will say that. He doesn't deserve it because the rulings that he made with respect to provisional ballots, so that they weren't going to be counted, were counter to providing opportunity for people to vote. Any African American who has his position by virtue of people voting ought to welcome people into the process. And you certainly shouldn't be there as a hindrance to people having the right to vote and to have their vote counted.
How did the events of September 11th in 2001 change the political landscape with regard to the aspirations of the disenfranchised? Has fear been a factor that has influenced the outcomes of elections and has influenced the sorts of things that candidates will say and campaign for?
Something is happening all over the world. In Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, Chile, Cuba, Venezuela, and now Mexico. People in Mexico have shut down Mexico City because they want to protect their right to vote. People in Haiti, who had nothing, they overturned the great, powerful United States will that was going to steal that election from René Préval. And they were determined to get the person that they voted for and the person who actually won in office, and they did. People in Côte d'Ivoire took to the streets and beat pots and pans and said, we are going to have our voices heard and our votes counted. And that's how what the West has called the wrong man, Gbagbo, became the president of Cote d'Ivoire. So something is sweeping the world. America is not immune to that. But in order for the kind of change to take place in America that is taking place all over the world, Americans have got to stand up. They've got to stop being afraid. And certainly, I'm getting ready to get in trouble. We certainly shouldn't allow a den of liars and thieves who happen to inhabit the executive branch of our government to instill such fear in us that we forget our fundamental freedoms. Those are freedoms that we have to fight for. Those are freedoms that we have to stand up for. And as we remember people in the past who stood up for our freedoms, and we cherish them in memory after they are long gone, we've got to create the stand-up leadership of today. And we've got to understand how the media will treat those people. J. Edgar Hoover was able to use the media in order to denigrate the leadership that would challenge the fundamental structure that the powers that be had placed around our country. And so we have to thank goodness for outlets like Pacifica and for alternative media and for community radio, because that's where the truth can be told. We've got to strengthen, we've got to support, and we've got to stand up. And most importantly of all, it's got to be people from all walks of life, people from all colors, creeds, backgrounds, and languages. We all have to come together and make this country what it is supposed to be and what George Bush says it is, and we know that it is not.
Well, you're sounding proactive there. Do you have specific recommendations for what the next steps people should take would be? For instance, what about the machine technologies for voting? Should we go back to paper ballots? Is there a way to make the machines work? What about social organizations? Where should people put their energies?
We don't have to have a Diebold democracy, and technology is not the problem. It's the people who control the technology who are the problem. In fact, there was an African-American man by the name of Ethan Gibbs who had a company called TrueVote that had a machine that was state-of-the-art. It did everything that the computer experts and voting rights activists and the politicians would want a machine to do. But he didn't have the lobbyists, and you know, he wasn't able to make those backroom deals in order to get his machine as the machine around the country. Two brothers now, the Urosevich brothers from Diebold and ES&S, were able to work their magic, their political magic, in the back rooms and enforce that on the American people. I've just had the opportunity to meet an IBM professional who 20 years ago got the first patent on a machine that he's going to demonstrate at a press conference that I'm going to hold in the upcoming days. And his machine is almost as good as that machine of Ethan Gibbs. Ethan Gibbs is now dead. I understand that his company lives on. TrueVote is the name of his company. And so we are looking actively for solutions that allow technology to be used, but that technology has to be open, transparent, and has to instill confidence in the American voters. At the same time, until we get that, I have also written a chapter in a book that recommends that we go back to counting by paper.
So what's next in your particular career? You're looking at the end of this present term in office, and then you will no longer be a member of Congress, but I can't imagine that you'll not be active at that point. What are your plans for the future?
Well, of course, we would invite all of your listeners to visit our website on a regular basis, www.cynthiaforcongress.com. And in the upcoming days, we will give regular updates about the, I didn't even get into the particulars that we have discovered in terms of election fraud in my own race.
By all means.
And, yeah, this can be your second program. What we've discovered is that people outside of the 4th Congressional District actually voted in the 4th Congressional District race. That means then that we don't know who voted in the 4th Congressional District. We don't have any confidence at all in the numbers. We are in the process now of gathering information through open records requests and from voters as to what their particular experiences were. After that is over, we will assemble the best minds that are available to us to come together with a strategy to deal with what we are clear about, is that there was an anomaly that took place in the 4th Congressional District. We have to make sure that no other candidate suffers from these kind of voter irregularities and no voters suffer from these kind of irregularities in the future. We will take appropriate measures in order to assure that. At the same time, though, as people visit our website for updates on that specific situation, we would also invite them to visit, because there will be updates as to what I plan to do in the future. I can tell the people that the powers that be are sadly mistaken if they think that they have shut my mouth and closed down the people's voice. That is not going to happen, at least for a little while yet. And there's more to come from me in the future.
Speaking of shutting down voices, some of the voices that were notably absent in both the investigation and the calls for investigation into what happened, especially in the 2004 election, have been the Democratic Party. My own experience investigating election fraud, which we know to have occurred in Ohio, is that those of us who are independent are often the only ones in the field. And the Democrats who are promised, the lawyers who are supposedly looking into things, are nowhere to be found. We've asked people at boards of elections if they've seen them, and they haven't. We're the first ones there. Why has the Democratic Party responded with such a lackluster kind of effort to look into this, especially when they stood the most to gain?
Well, of course, you know, I would never try to speak on behalf of the Democratic Party. I don't think that I can respond for the Democratic Party, because I certainly have not been one who has been shy about voicing my opinion on anything. And so the failure to speak up, the failure to be an opposition party, the failure to be a protector of the American people is something that the Democrats are going to have to explain. For example, there's much ado being made now about Hurricane Katrina and 1 year after. But I can tell you that Democrats were told by the Democratic leadership in the House of Representatives, do not participate in the select committee that was formed to investigate what went wrong with Hurricane Katrina. Of course, I didn't listen to the Democratic leadership, because my responsibility is to the people. And I participated, and you can read our findings, which are in a separate paper as a part of the overall Hurricane Katrina report. And I would want your listeners to read the work that I've done on Hurricane Katrina, to read the work that I've done. Of course, I sat on the House Armed Services Committee, and the work that we've done with respect to U.S. military policy at home and abroad. And, of course, they're trying to break down the Posse Comitatus and allow military operations to take place inside the United States. And we also disagree vehemently with that. We've written about that. We've spoken about that in committee where it counts. So I don't understand people who don't stand up and people who don't speak out. And that's why I intend to provide that voice and that leadership for people who value stand-up, uncompromising kind of leadership that I know more Americans are calling for now than even in the past.
So in 2 years, 4 years, 2008 and beyond, how do you see things progressing?
I think people all over America will have an opportunity to have an impact on the future politics of our country. And that impact is going to be nothing but positive, and I intend to be a part of it.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Anything you would